The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
It is an interesting phenomenon that while we may be aware of events, we don't always understand them. I want to ask you a question. I put a few numbers, samti ktzat misparim, po al haluach, mi sheyachol lirot, okay, whoever can see these numbers. What are these numbers? Don't yell it out, just raise a hand if you recognize a number. Pardon? Years, okay, years, could be. What is this number? 1948, right? Tashach, Melchemet Ha'atzmaut. Okay, what is this? Balfour Declaration, 1917. What is this? 1956 was what? Sinai Campaign. What is this? 1967, okay. What is this? 1099. Which crusade? First crusade. Well, you had a choice, right? First crusade, all right. What is this? 82. Oh, you guys are good. Lebanon War, okay. What is this? What is 1895? The beginning of Herzl's decision to create the Zionist Congress. Good. Okay, yes. The expulsion from Spain. Good. Okay? What is this? Oslo. Okay? What is this? Okay, this is when all hell breaks loose. Okay? And what are we left with? 1882. Who was assassinated? This is one of the most significant events in modern Zionist history. In 1882, the Tsar Alexander was assassinated. And they were looking for someone to blame, because the authorities couldn't take responsibility for this. Ken be 1882, ken ratzchu et hazar berusia. So in 1882, right, the Tsar was assassinated. Now the problem is, you got to blame somebody, because otherwise the police are responsible. So they picked the Jews, because the Jews were very prominent in the world of communism and socialism and blah blah blah, right? And there began a series of forced pogroms, government-sponsored pogroms. Ma perush, what does that mean? A state-sponsored pogrom? It means that the local commissar, a mishtara, leave a sign on the door, mashirim shelet, you know, next week, on Wednesday, the police will be taking a vacation. Now, if you're a Cossack and you live in the neighborhood, you know what that means. And over the course of the next couple of years, hundreds of Jews were murdered, right? The epitome, the apex of this was Kishinev in 1903. Between 1882, right, and 1914 when World War I began, 2.2 million Jews, 2.2 million, this, the largest single migration of the Jewish people since the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, 2.2 million Jews left the eastern pale of Russian settlement. Now, most of those Jews went to America, 1.8 million of them. It's very interesting, by the way, that almost all of them went through Germany. And they should have stayed in Germany because it would have made a lot more sense. They were offered rights, they were offered land rights, something they couldn't get in 1882 in America. But it's almost like the Jewish people had a collective sense, we've been here before. This isn't where we should be. And that collective sense is probably what saved the Jewish people, because 60 years later, in 1940, there was a sizable Jewish community in America. Otherwise they all would have gone up in smoke with everybody else. A trickle of those Jews, approximately 30,000, end up coming to Israel. And that's what's called the first Aliyah. Now, one of the challenges, and I'm going to leave this question, I'm not going to answer it, is if you study anything in the realm of history, where does the story begin? Okay, I once got asked to teach a course on Bayit Sheni. Right? Teach a course on Bayit Sheni. You know, easy thing to do. Bikshu memeni la'avir seminarium al tkufat Bayit Sheni. Now the problem is, you can't really teach the story of Bayit Sheni without understanding Ezra, Nehemiah, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, who came here, you know, we'll call it 516 before the Common Era, that's debatable, Seder Olam Rabba, and they sort of recreated the whole educational system in Israel. So you don't understand that unless you understand how Zerubbabel and Nehemiah came and built Bayit Sheni. And you don't really understand, you can't start there because you can't really understand what they're coming back to unless you understand Galut Bavel. But you can't understand Galut Bavel unless you understand the destruction of Beit Rishon. So you really have to study the end of Sefer Melachim. And in order to study Beit Rishon, you have to understand the Galut Aseret Alfim, and you have to understand what happened, and how they went from Babel to Persia. And in order to understand Galut Aseret Alfim, and to understand the destruction of Beit Rishon, you have to understand the Tkufa of the Melachim. But then you have to understand sort of who Malchut Yisrael was and who Malchut Yehuda was. So you really have to go all the way back to the time of Rechavam. But in order to understand Rechavam, you have to understand that Rechavam was the son of Shlomo, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. You have to understand how Beit Rishon was built. But in order to understand how Beit Rishon was built, you have to go back to Shlomo and decide why he built it, so you have to understand that he comes from David HaMelech and why he didn't build it. But in order to understand David HaMelech, you have to study Sefer Shmuel. Because who is David HaMelech if you don't understand Sefer Shmuel? So you have to study Shmuel. But you can't really understand Shmuel unless you understand that this comes at the end of the Tekufah of the Shoftim. So you have to study Shoftim. But if you want to understand Shoftim, you got to study Sefer Yeshua, because otherwise you don't get what they're doing in Israel in the first place. So you got to study Sefer Yeshua. But in order to understand Yeshua, you have to understand Le'amush Torah Mipicha, that, you know, Ve'lo'amush Mitoch Ha'ol, that Yeshua is the student of Moshe Rabbeinu. So you have to study who Moshe was. Which really means you have to understand how Moshe died and why he didn't come in. But in order to understand who Moshe was, you have to understand what 600,000 Jews are doing in the desert to begin with. So you have to all go back to Shemot and study Yitzhak Mitzrayim. But how do you understand Yitzhak Mitzrayim if you don't understand how they got to Mitzrayim? So you got to study the story of Yaakov and Yosef and the brothers and everything else. But who is Yaakov if you don't understand Yitzchak? And who is Yitzchak if you don't understand Avram? So you got to go back to Bereishit. But of course you got to understand what Avram is doing there and why Avram is the first Jew and why not Adam HaRishon. So you got to study Noach and you got to study Adam HaRishon. But you don't understand what people are doing in the world unless you understand how God created the world. So you got to go back to the beginning of Bereishit. But if you don't understand who God is, then what's the point of studying the creation of the world? So you got to figure out who God is. So how do you ever teach Jewish history? You understand? So talk about the Six-Day War. Where does the Six-Day War come from? How did it start and how did it end? So, I'm going to give you 20 minutes on the Six-Day War. But I want you to know, analyzing a piece of this as a microcosm is an absurd thing to do. You can't really understand the Six-Day War unless you understand 56 and 48 and how we got there. But because we only have a short amount of time, we'll take a look at the Six-Day War, right? But I hope if nothing, pardon? 1267, one of the big challenges is, where did Zionism begin? Most people think Zionism began with Theodor Herzl. But I want you to know that if Zionism would have begun with Theodor Herzl, you know, people pay lip service to this, but in the first, really the second Zionist Congress, there was a big debate as to whether we should accept the offer of the British to create a Jewish state in Uganda. And we don't understand this, right? There was a big vote. And the Jews, almost all of whom were completely secular by their own definition, right? Many of them voted to go to Uganda. It was a very close vote. I think something like 56% was what carried the day. Theodor Herzl voted to go to Uganda. Theodor Herzl felt better to take, you know, a state in the hand than to wait for one in the bush, if that works, right? And by the way, just so we're clear on this topic, right? Sheherzl ratza lakim medina yudit, or ayah mukhan, but Uganda, we're so sure that he was wrong. But let me tell you something. If there would have been a Jewish state in Uganda, maybe the Holocaust never would have happened. So that's a very complicated question. What do we need a Jewish state for? Why do we need a state of Israel? You know? And I'd be happy to talk about that topic, but I was asked to talk about the Six-Day War since you saw, you know, give up the Tachmoshet today. But I want you to know that in our ongoing attempts to develop a relationship with each other, we are going to find a time to discuss that question. That is absolutely one of the biggest questions that you have to struggle with this year. Why am I here? Why do I need a Jewish state? How much easier would life be if we didn't have a Jewish state? Why is the land so important? So you give back a little land if you could really get peace. And I'm not talking about the current hitnatkut. Because you could at least make a case, you could debate whether or not you're going to get peace by giving that and who you're giving it to. But what if you really had a partner for peace? What if you really had Arabs that if you gave them a piece of land, you would really get peace? Could you then give it away? Difficult question. And in order to answer that question, I have to understand why I need it to begin with. Right? And this is a critical question in understanding these issues. Because I want you to understand, in 1948, right, we had a mission. And we were very clear on what that mission was. That mission was to build a state so the Jews would have a place to go to, so that the Holocaust would never happen again. And that was their mission. And they succeeded. And if you ask the average Jew fighting to build a state of Israel why we need to build a state of Israel, they would basically tell you, because we have nowhere else to go. Where would the Jews go? I mean, we don't really think this through. You know, I heard they've changed it now, but when I went to the Washington Holocaust Museum, so maybe you remember this, there's a big picture all the way at the end when you finish going through, it's like VE Day. Tmuna gdola, chayal amerikai, יותר נכון ימאי, בתוך Times Square, והוא מחבק איזה אחות שמה, and everybody screaming and cheering and confetti, right? ניצחון, we won. Right? Do you remember this is again? In Yad Vashem, it doesn't go like that. There's no big party. Victory over Europe is not the end. Because the last stage of the depiction of the Holocaust, the survivors. You know, we don't think about this. We think the Holocaust was over in 1945, but this is not true. Imagine for a moment that it's 1933, and you're a third-year law student. You're 6 to 12 months away from getting your law degree, and you're studying in Heidelberg. Okay? And then Hitler comes to power. And the first thing Hitler does, lo rotzim ochei din yudin. So you get thrown out of law school. So you never get to graduate. And then a few years later, you get kicked out of your house, and you get thrown into the ghetto. And then comes Kristallnacht, and maybe they send you off to Dachau. And maybe you actually survive 6 years in the hell of the German concentration camp system, and maybe you're liberated in 1945, but you're not really free, you're just liberated. Now you're sitting maybe in Majdanek, and the Russian army is guarding the camp. And maybe by 1947 you realize this is going nowhere, so you join one of the illegal immigrants, and maybe you actually climb over the French Alps, all the way to Italy, where in 1948 you finally get on a ship. And maybe you get to Israel in Tashach in 1948, right? And just like Baruch Shapiro, you join the fight. And maybe you actually survive the War of Independence. And in 1950, when the armistice is signed, you realize we have a state. And in 1951, you finally get released from the army. 18 years after you were in your third year law school, you have no home, you have no family, they're all wiped out. No parents, no children, no wife. Maybe back then you were 23. That makes you now 41. You have no profession, no degree, not a penny to your name. What do you do? That's why, by the way, survivors in 1950 are taking any profession they can find, and why there was a certain honor to being a bus driver. The bus drivers in Israel in the 50s and 60s, these were the people who built the state of Israel. The garbage men. And there was a certain value to that. So that's 1948. In 1948 we had a mission. And that mission was very clear. We had to build a state because we had nowhere else to go. There was nowhere. There were hundreds of thousands of Jews wallowing in the DP camps in Europe. They had nowhere to go. Nobody wanted them. Not America with its quotas. Not England. Europe was a Jewish graveyard. So they had nowhere else to go. After the Six-Day War, something changed, and the world opened up. There was a realization that Israel was not going to be pushed into the sea, that this was a state that the world was going to have to deal with. And all of a sudden, Jews had a lot of choices. And in the Yom Kippur War, when Jews started coming home in body bags, Israeli soldiers, people started asking, wait a second, so why am I doing this? We could have gone back to Germany. So if you have a lot of choices, you start to ask yourself, so why am I doing this? That's a big problem. But that was not the case in 1967. In 1967, there was a very clear mandate, and everybody knew why we were here, because there was nowhere else to go. Number one. Number two. We think that the Six-Day War was a Six-Day War. Does anybody here know, just by raising your hand, how long do you think the Six-Day War lasted? Just out of curiosity. 6 days. Nope. How long do you think the Six-Day War lasted? Anybody? Okay, the Six-Day War actually lasted a little over 3 months. And that's because the perception people have of a Six-Day War is how long I'm actually shooting at the Syrian soldiers that are opposite me. But that's not how we define a war. War begins when I got to put on my uniform and I got to leave my home. Now in May of 1967, okay, actually the end of April, Nasser did something which technically is an act of war. Nasser was the president of Egypt. He was not exactly a big pro-Israel fan. He had visions of uniting the Arab world under one umbrella. Does anybody know, by the way, how many Arab and Muslim states surround the nation of Israel? 8. Nope. 22 states. 22 countries. Right? We are just as much threatened by Iraq and Iran. No. right? Touching on his borders is easy. You have, 1 second. 1267 is when, 1267 is when the Ramban came here. You could make a case, actually from this, from the perspective of the study of the population decline and growth in this country, the nadir of the Jewish population in this country was 1266, before the Ramban came. When the Ramban came, he gave something to the Jewish community here. The world started to realize, Jews around the world realized that if the Ramban could come here, maybe it was time to start coming home. And that began a trickle, which by the time Rav Yaakov Beirav came here after the Spanish expulsion, was really the beginning of the return of Jews to the land of Israel. You could make a case for that. Pardon? 1990 was the Gulf War. That was a watershed event, but we don't have time to do everything. Just so we're clear, okay? I am not an artist, so I apologize in advance. Okay, what's this? Haifa, good, okay. What's this? No, that's down here. Okay? Alright? Okay, right, more or less. You've got the Kinneret here, it's not exact. Yam HaMelech, okay. Negev Eilat. That's Eilat. We'll call this Tel Aviv. We'll call this Yerushalayim. We'll call this Tzfat. This is the Golan. Okay, got it? Everybody good? Okay, this is not exact, don't hold me to it. We'll call this over here somewhere Kiryat Shmona. Alright? I think that pretty much, and this is Haifa. Okay? Alright, now, here we got Lebanon. Always fun. Syria. Jordan. And right now, Egypt. Okay? And let's just say Saudi Arabia over here, and Iraq and Iran, etc. out here. Alright. So, here's where it gets interesting, okay? 1967, okay? In order to get to Eilat, now remember back then, alright? So, we have this, what do we do with this? This funny little thing called the Green Line, right? Before I even explain what this is, anybody know why it's called the Green Line? Yes. Excellent, they used a green pen. Makes you wonder what would have happened if they had one of those invisible ink jobs. But anyway, okay. Alright, so they used, this is not exact. What happened de facto after 1950 when we signed the armistice line was that we were very into planting and we planted lots of trees and growth and fields and they didn't. So from the air, you could actually more or less see where the border ran by the green on one side and the other. But that's no longer true. Anyway, let's just say that if this is Ra'anana. By the way, want to give yourself a goal, a good goal to have, etgar, for the end of this year, okay? There are 25 or so major places on the Israeli map that you should be able to know Baal Peh, okay? If you spent a year here and you don't know where Be'er Sheva is in relationship to Dimona, something's wrong. If you don't know where Ra'anana and Herzliya are, okay? If you don't know which is north of which, Kesaria or Hadera, if you don't know where Nahariya is, if you don't know where Kiryat Shmona is, if you don't know exactly where the Golan is, and you don't know where Emek HaBachai is, there are certain places on the map that you should know Baal Peh. And this is a good thing to do. It's a good thing to play this game. I used to play this game with my kids. I would put a map, give them a pen, and give them a list of, and they would have to write it down. Okay? Anyway, I'm not going to get all into that. More or less, okay? The Green Line runs somewhere along here. Okay? Masada is this side of it. Right? And it goes something like this. Something like that. It's not exact, but we'll give it a take more or less, okay? Right? This is, okay, right here, down to Hebron, okay, etc. Okay? This handprint, that's the Green Line. After 1950, this was Israel. This was Israel. Remember that 70% of the country that was Israel between 1950 and 1967 was completely arid land. All right? Not a lot growing there then, not a lot growing there now, although that's about to change, but that's another discussion, okay? And this corridor, alright, this corridor, this was the lifeline, right here. This is called Gush Dan. When you hear about Gush Dan, it goes really from Haifa all the way down, okay, if this is Caesarea, okay, and you have Herzliya and Ra'anana and Kfar Saba over here, okay, and then you have Tel Aviv down, in Tel Aviv, and then Rishon, and you have Rehovot, and Ashkelon, and Ashdod, or vice versa, whatever, and this is Hevel Gush Katif. Okay? And if anybody tells you it's not Gush Katif, it's still Gush Katif. Just who's living there is a little different. But anyway, we won't go there. Anyway, so this is the green line. Now down here, okay, is a canal. And that canal comes up, right, from Port Said all the way up towards Eilat, right? And it looks something like this. If this is Eilat, it comes from here, okay? And it's a canal. It's called the Straits of Tiran. Look at a map, look at a globe, see what it looks like, see where it is in relationship to Africa, in relationship to Europe, and you will understand that for shipping to reach Israel in the south, okay, you're talking about the savings of some double the journey. So in order for Israel to survive, right, ships have to be able to come through the Straits of Tiran. Nasser closes the Straits of Tiran. Straits of Tiran, like I said, is all the way to the southern part of the Sinai. Again, look at a map. I didn't know that we were doing this, so I didn't bring a map, but okay. Southern Straits of Sinai. After 1956, there was an agreement reached. That was actually the first time, among other things, that we had these types of problems. Israel landed in Sinai, okay, and British and French soldiers basically came and relieved the Israelis, and that's a whole discussion in and of itself. And there was an agreement that there would be UN peacekeepers. Okay, this is very, very important. Okay, what are the two instances that UN peacekeepers were supposed to preserve the peace and did not succeed? Six-Day War, what's the second? Pardon? Nope. Lebanon. The Lebanon War started because the UN failed. Very simple. Okay, so Egypt told the UN forces to leave the Sinai. They were the buffer, closed the Straits of Tiran, two acts of war, and Israel had no choice. The radio airwaves were full of Egyptian, Syrian promises to push Israel into the sea. Remember, this is only a 19-year-old country. Not only is it a 19-year-old country, it's a 19-year-old country that had 600,000 people in 1948, and then more than doubled its population by bringing, some say 750, some say 850,000 Jews from all of the Arab countries. If you were a Jew living in Iraq in 1950, your life was in danger. If you were a Jew living in Syria, there was actually a blood libel in Syria in 1951. Right? So by hook and crook, through bribery and secret night crossings, the Israelis brought every Jew from the Arab countries that was willing to come, which was approximately 85% of the Jewish population of the Arab countries. This country doubled. Can you imagine? That would be the equivalent, and by the way, these people came with nothing. They came with the clothes on their back, nothing. Can you imagine, we don't have much time. Can you imagine if America brought 450 million immigrants from Mexico in the next 2 years? Can you imagine? Okay, that was what Israel did. So in 1967, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, they're looking at a country with a deficit economy, okay, with no money, with 60% of the population only 5 years out of Mabarot, out of refugee camps, right? And they close the Straits of Tiran, and Egyptian forces start moving up through the Sinai. And Syria, Egypt, Jordan made a pact that they were going to attack as one. Iraq joined this fray. Syria moves its forces up onto the Golan Heights, which at that time were under Syrian control. Israel has no choice. Israel has to mobilize its army. Okay? There is a common mistake that is made. People think that the Israeli army is the standing army. That's not true. The Israeli army, as it stands now, the people that are currently in uniform, is approximately, we'll call it, somewhere between 15 and 20% of the Israeli army. Right? The job of that army, of the standing army, of the 18 to 21, 22-year-olds who are holding the line, is to be able to hold the line until the reserves come up. Right? The Israeli army itself, from a strategic point of view, cannot hope to fight the battles that need to be fought until the reserves come up. So Israel has no choice. Israel mobilizes her reserves. Now you have to imagine that for the entire month of May, the Arab airwaves are full of screaming cries to destroy the state of Israel, and the entire Israeli army is mobilized along her borders. And that means that factories stop. That means that schools have no teachers. That means that industry grinds to a halt, etc., etc., etc. How long can that last? The economy begins to fall apart. Israel gets messages from the United States that if they fire the first shot, right, they'll be on their own. But finally, Levi Eshkol decides that there's no choice. We can't wait for the Egyptians and Syrians. By the way, the reason it took the Egyptians and Syrians so long to attack was because they figured the longer they kept the Israelis mobilized, the more of a probability that they would simply run out of fuel, run out of food, run out of everything necessary to run the army. So in 1967, I think I'm right, June 5th in the morning, right? What day of the week was it, by the way? Pardon? I have no idea. Somebody let me know. On June 5th, I think it was a Sunday, but I could be wrong. Oh, no, that was 11 or more. In June 5th, 1967, the Israeli Air Force, this is the story everybody knows, the Israeli Air Force in three naglot, in three sorties, two of them in the south, right, takes out 85% or 83% of the Egyptian Air Force on the ground, and basically the war is won in the first 6 hours of battle. Air superiority, first in Egypt and then in Syria, goes to the Israelis. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, basically the skies belong to Israel. And that's why the Six-Day War was a Six-Day War. Okay? And that's why the Russians, by the way, arm the Syrians and the Egyptians with SAM-6 missile sites. And that's why the 1973 war was not the Six-Day War. Okay? That, in a nutshell, is how the Six-Day War began. Let me give you maybe 5 more minutes, all right? Because I know we're running out of time. What about the implications? What about the implications? I'll tell you an interesting thing. I once had a group. I live in Efrat. And technically I live over the Green Line. I am a settler. It's a whole discussion. I haven't quite figured out what defines one Jew in Tel Aviv not as a settler and another Jew as a settler. Oh, we could go there sometime, right? I once had a group that came to visit me. And they were doing a tour of Gush Etzion, which is just south of Jerusalem. Who here has been to Gush Etzion? Oh, you all have to come to Gush Etzion. When are they coming to Gush Etzion? Soon. Okay, we got to go to Gush Etzion. When you come to Gush Etzion, I'll be glad to take you around. Anyway, so I'm at this group, whatever, and we're having this whole discussion. And one girl raises her hand and wants to know where the river is. I said, river? What river? So she looks at me and says, well, the Jordan River. Isn't this the West Bank? And that was a novel thought. I had never thought about that before, right? Never thought about. And I realized that's a brilliant term. Because the West Bank implies, right, that all we need is just this little strip along the river. Right? That's what I think of as the West Bank. Okay? But all of this is 1,600 yards. The edge of Qalqilya. 1,600 yards from Kfar Saba, from Manana. 70% of Israel's population lives in this zone. Pardon? It's about 1,600 meters. This whole area here, okay, this whole area here is very densely populated. By the way, if you want to see this, alright, take a ride, go on a bus, whatever, on road number 6, Kvish Mispar Shesh, that's the new Trans-Israel Highway, south to north, and go up to, I don't know, Netanya. Go up to Kesaria, okay? And you will see that the road drives right along the edge of what we call today the separation fence, which is, by the way, the only propaganda victory Israel has ever had, right? It's really a wall, but okay. And you'll see very clearly, you'll see Taibe, you'll see Kfar Qasim, you'll see Qalqilya, hundreds of thousands of Arabs that live along this area. And the closest spot between what is pre-67 Israel, right, and pre-67 Arab territory, what was then Jordan, right, is between Qalqilya and Kfar Saba. Kfar Saba is right next to Ra'anana, which is just north of Tel Aviv. Okay? And 1,600 yards, by the way, is heavy machine gun fire range. You don't even need a missile. Okay? So I never thought of that. That's a brilliant term, the West Bank. Because the West Bank means that there's just this little sort of strip of land, and what's a big deal? Just give them the West Bank. You have to see a map to understand that the West Bank is the whole center of Israel, right? One of the reasons why the Six-Day War was so important, and this is a dangerous topic because, you know, it's a very, very healthy thing to get a balanced perspective on all these issues, to understand what the right says, to understand what the left says, to form your own opinions. Anytime you hear this topic from Israeli, you should know, and I'm no exception, I can't be objective. It's not possible to be objective, and it's healthy to hear both sides. And by the way, you can only disagree with a perspective when you understand where it's coming from and you respect where it's coming from. And there are definitely two sides to every coin. So we don't have the time to get into both sides, but we could do that one time if you want. Right? But essentially, this was as much a strategic battle, the Six-Day War, as it was, a battle of politics or greater Israel or whatever you want to call it. because after the Six-Day War, this becomes the border. Now, by the way, this is even more important today than it was in, you know, sort of understanding this in 1970, because right now, right, in the process post-Oslo, we have given back or away, depending on your perspective, all the major, you know, Arab cities. Ramallah, Jenin, Shechem, you know, I'm not going to dot them all, but suffice it to say they're all through here, Hebron, Beit Lechem, Yericho, right? And basically what happened was that we have multiplied in the last few years our borders by 15 times. In other words, think about it. If this is your border, if this is your border, okay, right? So that's very simple. Very simple. You patrol on this side, you build up fences, and you're done. But if you've got a border over here around Beit Lechem, and another border around Hebron, and another border around Yericho, and another border around Ramallah, and another border around Jenin and Shechem, etc. So think about all of that border and how complicated it gets, and you realize you've multiplied your borders by 15 times. This is, by the way, a tremendous challenge because the Israeli army does not really have the manpower to do this. That's one of the reasons why, among other things, some felt that we had to give away Gush Katif and whatever else it is, trying to create these borders. Irrelevant for the moment whether that's right or wrong, right? There is another solution, but we won't go there, right? I guess the last point that's worth considering in a post-1967 world, right, is where do we fit in, you know? So what do you do with that? I mean, that ultimately is the question. And I'm going to leave you with this question, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it another time, because I get nervous when people ask questions and get answers right away. This is something you have to think about, you know? And it's good that you're having this discussion and you're thinking about this at the beginning of the year. You know, we're sitting in the West Bank, right? I mean, you were up on the roof, and that way was Har HaBayit, that's east. And this was west. And all of this was Jordanian territory for 19 years, between 1948 and 1967. We were not, by the way, allowed to do what we're doing now. We would have been arrested. Okay, Jews weren't allowed in here. We were sitting in the West Bank. And, by the way, it's an interesting question. I'm reasonably sure, and I'm not debating this policy, I'm reasonably sure that nobody here will go for a tiyul on that side of Har HaBayit, East Jerusalem. You won't go there. They won't take you up for a walk on Har HaZeitim. And you... What? Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Kol HaKavod, good. You're the exception. Pardon? I'm reasonably sure most of you will not go walking through Beit Lechem, and I would highly advise you to not go walking through Beit Lechem these days. But we used to go through Beit Lechem all the time. And there's some amazing sites in Beit Lechem. Think about it. That's the city where David HaMelech came from. Right? And even if you go to Har HaZeitim, you won't go to Har HaZeitim like you come to the old city. I mean, you can walk in around here on your own. And you know your way around. And they tell you where not to walk and where to walk. And you know what? You don't even have to go to Har HaZeitim. There's some amazing Jewish sites when you go through Shar Shechem and you head north inside the old city. But none of you will go there. And by the way, just to be clear, you shouldn't go there on your own because you don't know where you're walking. And there's enough to see, Baruch Hashem. But that's an interesting question. And you know what the biggest question about that is? Never mind security issues. Okay? What percentage of Israelis visit Yerushalayim in the old city on a regular basis? You'd be shocked. Most Israelis, when I say most, I mean over 52% of Israelis today have never been to Yerushalayim. Can you imagine that? That's unbelievable. That's like if you live in London, how often do you go to the Tower of London? Right? If you ask what percentage of Israelis have ever visited East Jerusalem, have ever been up on Har HaZeitim, right? Ever went to Yericho when Yericho was ours? We don't go there. So that raises an interesting question. What do we need it for? I mean, most Jews don't go up on Har HaBayit. I'm putting aside the politics. Can you daven on Har HaBayit? Not daven. Where can you go? Not go. Women versus men. Mikvah, not mikvah. If we don't go there, it doesn't seem to be something we can't live without. Wait for Mashiach. Maybe a certain population of Jews are right. Wait for Mashiach. He'll give it all back to us. Until then, what's the difference? Difficult question. That is absolutely, on this topic, the most significant question for you to ponder. Because when you are back wherever you go, if we don't have our way and get you to stay forever, which is where you should be, you can tell your parents I said that. But if, Nebuch, you feel an importance to transmit all your experiences here back to the Jews in America, England, South Africa, Australia, wherever else you came from, France, right? This will be the question you're asked. Why do we need this? What's the point? So we took it in 67, now we're in the process of giving back. Was it worth it? What's the point?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.